There is no reason why we cannot wage an effective fight against those who have swarmed to harm us or our allies while we respect our most honored constitutional traditions.
That is Attorney General Eric Holder speaking yesterday. And what he's referring to, albeit obliquely, is the recent release of 9 formerly secret documents that seem to show that after 9/11, the Bush administration legally claimed that the president and the president alone could basically do anything he wanted if it was in the name of conducting the war against terror. So what do we know about this specifically so far? Well, this week, the Justice Department released these 9 memos that detail, among other things, the Bush administration's legal justification for their policies on rendition, their claim that prisoners held outside the United States were not legally protected from torture, and how the military, U.S. military, could search and seize terror suspects in the United States, usually can't use the military domestically, and without warrants. And the CIA acknowledged this week that it has destroyed 92 videotapes that depict the interrogation of high-value al-Qaeda suspects. Joining me now to talk about all of this is Scott Horton, a law professor and contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, where he writes the No Comment blog. And so there is no confusion about where he's coming from on this issue. He also wrote the Harper's December 2008 cover story, Justice After Bush, Prosecuting an Outlaw Administration. So, Scott Horton, welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be with you.
And I'll also mention that hearings are taking place in Congress right now on all of this, chaired by Senator Leahy. And we're going to play a few clips from just a few moments ago as we get them ready for you. So it's going to be interesting to hear how the Senate Judiciary Committee is holding hearings on this. But let's talk about these 9 memos. 9 is a lot. What are the headlines? What powers and rights do they cover? Is there a pattern? Is there an overall goal?
Well, there is an overall pattern here, which is that the function of each of these memoranda is to aggrandize the powers of the president. And the tool that's consistently used is his commander-in-chief powers. So the memoranda consistently say that as commander-in-chief in wartime, he is capable of overcoming legislation and also protections in the Constitution and implementing his plans, protecting the nation. I'd say the most striking of these memoranda is one that's dated October 25, 2001. It was written by John Yoo, and it says that the president, if he chooses to do so, can use the military to fight terrorism inside the United States. And in the process, he's not going to be bound by the Fourth Amendment and its restrictions on unreasonable searches and seizures, nor by the First Amendment and its guarantees of free speech and press, nor by the Posse Comitatus Act, which makes it illegal for the military to be used for domestic law enforcement purposes.
Give me the background on Posse Comitatus. Why can't they use the military for domestic law enforcement?
Well, you know, you've got exactly the right time to be asking that question. Yesterday was the anniversary of the Great Compromise of 1877 that led to the Posse Comitatus Act. It was essentially part of the package that ended Reconstruction in the South. And as you recall, even during the Civil War and certainly after, the Union maintained order through the military. So there were, there was military police, military courts throughout the South. And the Southerners chafed under this, and they demanded, as part of the package in which they confirmed the election of Rutherford B. Hayes, that this would end. So that was by the Posse Comitatus Act, which said that inside the territory of the United States, the military will not be used for police purposes.
And you conclude on your blog that John Yoo's Constitution, John Yoo, the legal advisor to Bush, who wrote the memo you cited from October 2001, among many others, John Yoo's Constitution is unlike any other I have ever seen. It seems to consist of one clause, appointing the president as commander-in-chief. The rest of the Constitution was apparently printed in disappearing ink. But I want to jump ahead from that memo, stark as it is, which was written just weeks after 9/11, to the final memo in this series, which was from January 15th of this year, just five days before the inauguration of Barack Obama, where Stephen Bradbury, the head of the counsel's office in Mr. Bush's second term, and I'm reading now from a New York Times editorial today, repudiated the earlier memos and tried to excuse them by saying that they were made, quote, in a time of great danger and under extraordinary time pressure. Does that at least mean that there was an evolution of thinking, that there was a learning curve, that there was this, oh my God, what do we do now, moment after 9/11, and that the same administration under George W. Bush was able to reflect, you know, 7 years later and say, well, maybe we didn't need to go that far?
Yeah, well, if that's the case, why did he do it as he was on his way out the door, you have to ask yourself. No, I think, first of all, did he repudiate them? I think if you read his memorandum very carefully, the language is, it's very, very clever. He repudiates specific statements contained in these memoranda, and he says that they shouldn't be relied upon. But, you know, it's less than an unequivocal repudiation of the memos. And remember, he left them in place all the way to the end of the administration, meaning that people could and probably did rely upon them. So why does he issue this memorandum on the way out the door? I think there's a giveaway in a footnote in the memorandum in which he says that this memo and these conclusions should not be used in connection with any bar disciplinary proceedings. Any review of the professional competence of the memoranda, because we know that the legal ethics watchdog at the Justice Department, the Office of Professional Responsibility, is in the process now of finalizing and issuing a sweeping report that has been more than 4 years in the making that deals with the legal competence and ethics of the so-called torture memoranda. And we also know that Stephen Bradbury himself was a target of this investigation. And I've been told by people inside the Justice Department that he was interviewed, and during the interviews he was pressed for an explanation as to why he left the U memoranda in place. So I think this is him suspecting that bad news is coming and taking some steps to protect himself.
So protect himself and also protect others in the administration?
I think certainly himself and perhaps others, yes.
Which brings us to the hearings that are taking place right now in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here's a clip of one of the witnesses, Vice Admiral Lee Gunn. He explains here why it is important, in his opinion, to conduct investigations of the past administration.
We're not done, and that's why I think that we need a serious inquiry into the way we've behaved for the last 7 years and the kind of orders and we've given and decisions we've made.
All right, so that's Admiral Gunn, and here's a clip of John Farmer, who is the former senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission, which, of course, did its own investigation of another major event. Lee Farmer explaining what an investigation into this stuff might look like.
Assuming that there is eventual agreement on the need for an investigation of detention practices, the next question is what form that investigation should take. One obvious option is a criminal investigation, either by the Justice Department or by a special prosecutor. This option has limited appeal in this context, in my opinion, for three reasons. First, prosecutions are necessarily narrowly focused on proving the elements of crimes in specific cases. Whatever broader context they provide is incidental to that primary purpose. Second, in the absence of generally accepted neutral fact-finding, criminal prosecutions by a successive administration may appear to be politically motivated. And third, it is not clear that criminal prosecutions will be efficacious in this context. Potential targets may well be able to invoke a viable advice of counsel defense. Another option would be congressional hearings. Certainly, Congress is capable of conducting thorough bipartisan investigations as part of its oversight responsibility of the executive branch. In my view, however, the highly charged politics of congressional hearings on this subject would frustrate any fact-finding effort. In my view, these considerations argue in favor of establishing an independent body to conduct fact-finding with regard to detentions.
John Farmer, former senior counsel for the 9/11 Commission, which, of course, was an independent commission of its own, and recommending something similar be set up. Was he talking specifically there, Scott Horton from Harper's Magazine, do you think, about the treatment of prisoners or larger issues?
Well, I think that's one of the questions that Senator Leahy and his committee are trying to address today, that is how to frame the mandate that would be given to a commission.
Uh-huh.
And Leahy himself has proposed a very, very broad mandate, but I think the things you just heard John Farmer say suggest why that may not be a good idea. It begins to look like political retribution or a witch hunt if it's completely open-ended. It begins to look like Ken Starr, who launches an investigation into Whitewater and winds up looking into the sex life of the president. No, I think for it to be credible, it needs to be thematically framed in a sensible way. And I'd say the policy that was formed with respect to to detainees and torture, military commissions, black sites, and things of that sort, that's pretty much at the core of the investigative area. But I'm not ruling out the fact that there may necessarily be a separate investigation dealing with the surveillance questions.
And we can take phone calls on this, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, as Congress and the U.S. public are still learning the extent to which the Bush administration was trying to, let's say, interpret the Constitution after 9/11, and people are asking, what should the consequences be? 212-433-WNYC, or post a comment or a question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And what about prosecution? You wrote in Harper's Magazine that investigative commissions can provide truth, but they cannot provide justice.
Yes, I think the comment that Farmer just made was spot on. That is, a prosecution may in fact be necessary as a part of the overall formula, but you're not going to learn all the details of what happened through a prosecution. That's because a prosecutor has, just as he said, his own narrow agenda, which may be to investigate a crime, prosecute and secure a conviction, and frequently keeping his hand of cards close to the vest is a part of a sensible operation for a prosecutor. In fact, it's ethically mandated. So it's not either or. In fact, it may well be that both are appropriate. But in terms of prioritizing them, I will put getting the truth out there first.
Ken in Edison, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling, Ken.
Hi. I just wanted to say that, we're dealing with people who have very little humanity. And what they did 9/11, and even subsequent to that, how they treated the people that they captured, I certainly have no sympathy for them, and I think that our government did whatever they did, they kept us safe from another attack like a 9/11 attack.
Scott Horton, want to engage with Ken?
Well, I think this is the mantra that we're going to hear from President Bush, and we have heard from his defenders consistently that he kept us safe. Of course, 9/11 occurred on his watch, and nothing like it occurred under any previous presidency. But the issue that drives this is certainly not sympathy for terrorists or people who were held in detention. In fact, much the opposite. One of the biggest concerns that people have is that they were not prosecuted. They should have been brought to account and prosecuted promptly. And as a result of the bungling that went on in the last administration, it is going to be much more difficult to bring them to account, to prosecute them, and to secure convictions. That's the problem here. I think it's the bungled handling of the detainees case, not sympathy for the detainees.
Ken, you want to come back on that? I always appreciate calling callers who disagree with the guest and disagree with what they think might be the prevailing attitude of the rest of the audience. Ken, go ahead.
Not a problem. I find it unfortunate that they're going to be subject to the civil liberties that the rest of us have. I don't think that they should be with the unfortunate failings of our court system. It's I think just way too liberal to actually be handling those cases, and that part is unfortunate.
Ken, thank you very much. So Scott Horton, could you make the case that these policies may have, in fact, as Ken says, prevented further terrorist attacks? I mean, in December of last year, the White House also released a fact sheet that said six specific terrorist plots were thwarted on Bush's watch. And here's the list: an attempt to bomb fuel tanks at JFK Airport, a plot to blow up airliners bound for the East Coast, a plan to destroy the tallest skyscraper in Los Angeles, a plot by six Al-Qaeda-inspired individuals to kill soldiers at Fort Dix Army Base in New Jersey, a plan to attack a Chicago area shopping mall using grenades, and a plot to attack the Sears Tower in Chicago.
Well, torture wasn't necessary to interdict any of those plans. So I think there's a serious question about methods and departure from American law as they went about these things. And I think the methods that were used actually have made our job much, much more difficult. In fact, you can look at the testimony that Alberto Mora, the former general counsel of the Department of the Navy, gave last year. He said that, the legacy of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo has been the single most powerful recruitment poster for the jihadist terrorists that we're viewing as our adversaries in this. In fact, also Matthew Alexander, the interrogator who broke a number of terrorists in Iraq that succeeded in allowing the U.S. to take out al-Zarqawi, the head of al-Qaeda in Iraq, he said he had responsibility for debriefing all of the worst of the worst terrorists there. And he said 100% of them said the reason they enlisted and became terrorists and started making IEDs was that they had heard the story about what happened at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. So I think this demonstrates how these policies, in fact, have made us much less safe.
Deborah in Woodcliff Lake, you're on WNYC. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that I think we do ourselves a disservice on a very large scale when we consider the appearance of the way we go about investigating what may be a crime. I don't really think we need to concern ourselves with whether or not this appears partisan. When a crime has been committed or when there is the suspicion that a crime has been committed, we need to pursue an investigation of that. We do this on the local level if someone has been shot or if somebody has been, when there are instances of criminal behavior or suspected criminal behavior, we go about investigating that without concern for the appearances. And in this case, I think we stand to do ourselves a great public disservice by worrying if it appears partisan to look into what very definitely appeared to be violations of the Constitution and, crimes against, humanity in terms of the potential war crimes that have been committed here.
Thank you, Deborah. Al in Valley Stream, you're on WNYC. Hi, Al.
Yeah, hi. I really think we do ourselves a huge disservice the other way, actually. After the Second World War, if we had taken the Roosevelt administration to court after the incredible sacrifices made in World War II, there were any number of violations of the law, including Lend-Lease, which was an impeachable offense. He imprisoned 150,000 Americans. He opened every letter. He listened to every phone call. I mean, we had to survive first before we could have a court later on to decide what was, a check and balance that didn't quite, So we have to survive first.
Scott Horton.
Well, in fact, I teach national security law, and one of the things we look at are the allegations that the Roosevelt administration committed war crimes that could be held to account for. And the classic example that's always held up is the lease of ships to Britain at the beginning of the war. If you look at it, there's no there. In fact, everything that Franklin Roosevelt did, he did completely publicly. He solicited and obtained an opinion from his attorney general, and he went to Congress, disclosed it, and secured legislation making everything legal. So there was no violation of law. In fact, it makes for a very, very strong contrast with what Bush did, where everything was done in secret and clearly in violation of the law, including very, very distinct precedents.
Just briefly, because we're running out of time, what about the CIA's destruction of interrogation tapes that we learned about this week? The Justice Department is investigating that. Is there a potential crime there?
Absolutely. That destruction occurred after requests were made for these documents in pending litigations. Therefore, it's destruction, it's obstruction of evidence under a federal statute. And aside from that, it occurred after the Inspector General of the CIA, Helgerson, had determined that it would not be lawful for these things to be destroyed. Then they were destroyed. Very clear-cut case of illegal conduct.
Scott Horton, law professor, contributing editor at Harper's, where he wrote the writes the No Comment blog. He also wrote the Harper's December 2008 cover story, Justice After Bush, Prosecuting an Outlaw Administration. And, of course, we'll have more later in the day on the hearings that are taking place in both the Senate and the House today on what to do next in revisiting these Bush policies. Scott Horton, thanks for coming on.
Great to be with you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in a minute. Rufus Briscum, who is more from porn blogger to parent blogger. Stay tuned.